Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Governor Newsom says he gets it, and the people of California want action on homelessness. Last week, Newsom launched his multi-day trip up and down California, unveiling his vision for his second term in office. Last week, on Thursday, he made a big announcement in Sacramento, detailing his next move to get more unhoused people into better living conditions. At Cal Expo, the governor announced that the state is going to deliver 1,200 tiny homes to some of the state's most impacted cities, including roughly a third of those homes, amounting to about 350 to Sacramento. In addition to Sacramento, Los Angeles will get 500, San Jose will receive 200, and San Diego will get 150. But how much of a dent will the small structures make in California's unhoused crisis? And are people living in encampments willing to give them a try? CAP Radio's homelessness and housing affordability reporter Chris Nichols joins us to talk about the plan and several of the loose ends that still need to be worked out, including why some say this move is just a drop in the bucket. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me on Insight.
So, Chris, you talked to a lot of local leaders about this latest push for tiny homes. What are they saying about the governor's promise of 350 tiny homes in Sacramento?
They are saying that this is a positive step for the region. As we've reported in the past, there are more than 9,000 unhoused people in the county. That's a record high. But there are only about 2,000 shelter spaces between the city and county facilities. And new shelters are not cheap to build. Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg was at Cal Expo last week. He says the city and county are stepping up their efforts to tackle homelessness, but they need more resources like these tiny homes.
We're waiting for one thing, more beds, because we don't have the sufficient capacity. This is a godsend. And if it takes a couple months, it'll take a couple months. We'll do the outreach, and then we will have a place to actually bring people.
Okay, so the mayor just said it could be a couple months. When and where will they open?
Governor Newsom said the home should open by this fall, both here in Sacramento and around the state. He said he'll use the California National Guard to get them set up. The governor also said the state will pay for the homes. He estimated that cost will be about $30 million and that the state will pay for any related infrastructure. But local governments will pay to operate the sites and the services needed at these tiny home communities. The location for at least some of the Sacramento homes will be Cal Expo. There will be other locations in the area, but those have not been announced.
But Cal Expo, it's a pretty well-known location. It's home to the State Fair. Sacramento Republic plays their home soccer games there. Will the general public see the tiny home community?
Well, that's a good question. Officials have not said exactly where the tiny homes might be set up at Cal Expo, but I think if they follow the lead of other projects, there could be a fence that surrounds the homes, possibly a privacy fence. And there also could be a security station that checks people in and out of the community.
Chris, I mean, you and I just talked about Sacramento County, that there's a tiny home project in the south part of the city, South Sacramento, and it can take a while to open these sites. Remind us what the county is trying to do.
Yes, it can take a long time. In the county's case, they announced a project last April. It includes about 100 tiny homes at Florin and Power Inn Roads. But now, after several delays and cost overruns, the county might not open that site until late this spring. So that would be more than a year just to get it up and running.
And the city still has nearly 100 small homes and trailers, right, sitting in storage. What are the plans for those?
That's right. I know that's something that's really frustrating for a lot of people. Those have been sitting empty for nearly 2 years. The city had planned to use them at a few different sites, but they ran into regulatory problems, such as making them accessible to people with disabilities and meeting fire safety rules. City spokesperson Tim Swanson told me last week that these structures are still being considered for future projects, and that announcement should be coming in weeks or months.
And when we're talking about tiny homes, I mean, this is just one piece of a larger plan and vision. And in recent years, Chris, as you know very well, Sacramento and other communities have opened many different types of shelters, the traditional brick and mortar congregate shelters. They've also opened sanctioned tent encampments, safe parking areas. There's been some success with those and also some, honestly, some failures as well. What are the advantages of opening a tiny home community?
Well, for the tiny homes, typically you're going to have just one or two people in each unit. So I think they do offer people a greater degree of privacy. That's something that's really valued by people who live on the street. More privacy, especially compared with the traditional shelters that pack people into large rooms full of beds spread out across the floor. They're also hard-sided structures, so they can be locked from the inside. They offer people more safety and security than a tent, which of course can be damaged in all the rainstorms we've been having.
Given that Sacramento County, the latest point in time count was that there were at least 9,000 people experiencing homelessness in Sacramento County, and they're slotted to receive, or the city is slotted to receive, what, 350 tiny homes? So that seems like a fraction of the overall people who are experiencing homelessness. So where do they fit in the region's overall strategy to get people off the street?
I think they help places like Sacramento make at least a small dent in this overall problem. These shelters, if they move quickly, they can open in a matter of months, all as the city and county are trying to ramp up longer term efforts like mental health services and permanent housing. But they are not seen as a solution to homelessness. Instead, they're a place where people can hopefully stabilize and transition to the next step. Permanent supportive housing is still seen by many as the best long-term solution because it includes both housing and the full set of services. To really ensure someone doesn't fall back into homelessness, Sacramento Assemblyman Kevin McCarty, he also spoke at Cal Expo last week, both about the urgency of this problem and about past efforts to use the fairgrounds as shelter.
Sure, we'd love to have permanent supportive housing for 174,000 homeless across California, like the 2,000 homeless along our parkway just 100 yards behind us. But we need to focus on triaging today. Californians demand action today. We cannot wait. This helps get people out of the encampments along our beloved American River Parkway and from our central city freeways. Lastly, Governor, I thank you for having us here at Cal Expo, because as our mayor stated, this is a state asset and a key to helping us solve this critical problem. But it's been elusive to make it happen at this site. Just 2 years ago, you signed my measure greenlighting the placement of homeless facilities right here at Cal Expo, but we weren't able to make that a reality, and I'm confident we're going to do so this year.
All right, Chris, when it comes to homelessness advocates or even unhoused residents themselves, what do they want to see inside the structures?
The desire is for the homes to include heating and air conditioning, given Sacramento's relatively cold winters and the very, very warm summers. Ideally, advocates would like to see running water and restrooms. But if that's not possible, the goal is to provide access to things like showers and restrooms within the larger community. Daniel Lopez, a spokesperson for Governor Newsom, told us last week that all of the homes will be wired for electricity. Most will have a heating and cooling system. He said some will be plumbed for water, though others will require separate bathroom and laundry facilities. I also spoke with Angela Hassel, who is the executive director of Sacramento Loaves and Fishes, which offers homeless services near downtown. And here's what she said about the benefits of tiny homes.
There's always going to be something better, something more that we could do that would help folks along in their journey. But I do think that tiny homes are a good place to start because they are structured units that aren't going to, you know, ideally aren't going to just fall down or get shredded in a windstorm or a rainstorm. They're going to offer some more safety and security and just a private space for folks to kind of take a breath and then move into some of the other healing arenas. And it's bigger than that. We need more than tiny homes. We need more affordable, subsidized housing that comes with services, so permanent supportive housing. But this is a place to start, and I think that we need to kind of take this energy and propel it forward and keep doing more.
Right, Chris. You know, when it comes to an unhoused resident that you spoke with, I mean, what are they telling you about this? We have about 60 seconds left.
Sure. Well, I spoke with Joseph Gray. He's 65 years old, lives in his vehicle along the WX corridor, volunteers picking up trash for the downtown streets team. He really had some interesting comments about whether people would be open to the tiny homes. Here's part of my conversation with him.
What do you think about that strategy? You think it's a good one?
Well, yes, it is, and no, it isn't.
How do you mean?
The strategy will get a lot of people that will want to get off the streets available, but the fact that most of them don't want to get off of the street because they feel that if they're in a spot where people can look at them, then they're not able to do the little things that they don't want you to see them do.
And that is Cap Radio's Chris Nichols. As always, thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Vicky.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, starting your own business comes with some understandable learning curves. These unexpected challenges can offer lessons in resilience, patience, humility, even recalibrating a brand. But our next guest went through all of that and then some, to the point where their entire professional identity, built upon nearly a decade of hard work, was forced to be completely overhauled. Due to the fine print of a contract, she had to start completely over, including publicly changing her birth name. Cheval is now the designer of women's shoes. Named She is Cheval. But Cheval also calls herself a chief inspiration officer, using her life-changing experience as an entrepreneur to protect other young business owners. Cheval is also the founder of the nonprofit A Girl You Might Know to support young creatives, which includes guidance on their legal rights so they avoid being subjected to unfair terms. Cheval, thank you for making the time.
Hi, Vicky. Happy second day of spring.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I welcome spring. You know, it was so difficult for me to find the right way to introduce you because on the one hand, your story is so unique, but on the other hand, it can certainly help so many people. Where would you like to begin?
I do have a very rare story, and I've become a bit of a cautionary tale. Not just as a designer, former designer, but I think for a lot of artists in a variety of industries in which they have to sign some form of a contract. So my position right now is not really to play Monday quarterback. You know, I want to move forward and find a way to reinvent myself, share my story in a way that's productive for other young artists or entrepreneurs or designers, and warn them about the way contracts can be interpreted and why it's so important to really think about how to safeguard your interests so that what happened to me does not happen to anyone else.
Right. And this started when you were 25 years old, right? And like most of us, we're just trying to get our foot in the door and we're excited to sign a contract and enter into an agreement. But then that ended up having really traumatic consequences for you.
Absolutely. And I signed my contract without a lawyer. And while, you know, many people would argue 25 is not that young, you know, we really don't know what we don't know. And at the time, you know, I just was so excited for the opportunity and I felt a form of pressure that I think a lot of people can relate to, that if you don't agree, you know, or you push back or show that you're combative, you might miss out on an opportunity. And so one of the things I hope to do with A Girl You Might Know Foundation is to provide curriculum and negotiation tips and ways to kind of harness your own worth so that somebody else is not defining it for you.
Yeah. And your career involved before, you know, in your past Cheval life, you know, was you were on Say Yes to the Dress. You had a very successful career, but that also involved you when you didn't end up when you had that dispute with your contract negotiation, which is still continuing. I mean, you couldn't be a designer in the industry that you built a career on. You can't even use your birth name, right, publicly. And that's what led you to change it to Cheval.
Right. I cannot use my birth name in any business or commercial activity, nor can I actually use it to publicly identify. I had signed a long-term agreement, an employment agreement, and I gave rights for my name to be trademarked for the bridal collection I was designing. And years later, after, you know, being very hyper-focused and working my hardest to build up this brand, my contract was coming to an end. So I attempted to renegotiate, and I felt that there were circumstances that really did not exist at the time of signing that needed to be factored in. And so I was hoping to be seen as a respectable businesswoman that brought value in a variety of ways. But things for me, I felt, went outside the boundaries of what a head designer would do. So I felt like those should be factored in. And that actually led to a pretty tumultuous negotiation period that resulted in my former employer suing me in federal court while I was still working at the company. I resigned very quickly after that, but the main contention was over the rights of my name, as well as social media accounts that I had opened and ran as what I led to believe as my personal accounts. I had to turn those over. And since then, I've been involved in a two and a half year battle. And I've actually most recently been put under a provision that is 5 years long, in which I cannot identify to the trade as a designer in any of the categories my former employer manufactures and sells. So that is what I'm appealing at the moment. But in the meantime, you know, I can identify to non-competitive categories, which is where I found a saving grace in designing and creating shoes.
Yeah, and I was just also so surprised when reading your bio that they can still use your name, but you receive zero commission for your own designs, you know, following that. I remember signing my first contract as a broadcast journalist. I was around the same age as you. I didn't hire an attorney. I was just happy to get my foot in the door. You know, with that hindsight, now trying to help others, what do you want people to know? You know, what would you tell, you know, someone in a similar situation as your 25-year-old self?
Experience is the best way to learn. And there are so many of us that do learn the hard way and take the long journey. And I think it's important to share those stories to help young people that really share that sentiment of, oh, I want this opportunity. And, you know, I'm feeling pressured in certain ways to just go for it, you know, and go all in. And I think we need to understand that it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive with your rights. There's a way to, you know, sign that contract or get that partnership or that dream job you want, but also make sure that your interests are being presented and protected at the table.
Yeah, and we don't necessarily learn all that in school, right? You know, when we actually make a career for ourselves. Given that now you're approaching 4 years since that contract negotiation battle, you've since obviously resigned from that position, but you carved an entirely new path in fashion designing, including changing your name publicly. How do you reflect on this time in your life that really just kind of forced you to pivot in a way that was unexpected, to say the least?
I'm so grateful because while a lot of my identity has felt jeopardized, I've always found a big sense of purpose in bringing joy to women. And that has been in the form of creating. And when you look at it from that big picture view, I saw a lot of opportunity to go down new rabbit holes and find a new way to express myself creatively, but still achieve that reciprocation and that moment of joy in making a woman feel excited or strong or just sparkly. And so that's kind of been my mentality in moving forward. And I can reach a lot more women now because shoes are so inclusive. I've, of course, got a lot to learn because I am diving into an entirely new trade where not my skill set is not as transferable. I did all of my work in a very specific category for my whole life. So it's been a really big challenge, but I also feel like I've got this great responsibility now because I have shared my story publicly. And I think a lot of people want a solution, you know, and they want to see, okay, well, what are we going to do with this now? So that's what the shoe industry has kind of brought for me. And it's also kind of opened the floodgates to other fashion categories and accessories and storytelling. So that's been exciting.
Given that you were forced to give up your passion and your profession, which was a part of your identity as a gown designer, you changed your name publicly and you lost ownership of those social media accounts that you built a following from. All of those individually are hardships in their own right, but is there one that hurt the most?
I feel like the sense of purpose was the toughest because for so long I identified as a wedding dress designer. And that has been my biggest dream my whole life. And when I was told that I could no longer do that for an extended period of time without a whole lot of real reason behind it, at least I couldn't find the reason, it took a while to become resilient to that concept. And I still struggle with it, but I think it's important to realize that relationships are so powerful and having a support system and people around you that really do want to see you succeed and make it to that next step and get past, you know, this point. I feel like for so long I was at a rock bottom stage and then like, oh, there's a crap door there, you know, and like, so it has felt like a big falling, but having people that have picked me up and gave me reason to believe in myself in a new way forward is the message that I want to give to other people because they could be facing some similar challenge just in a different way. And it's all about your response and how you take that next step forward, pun intended.
Yeah. And people may not initially think that of social media as a valuable asset, but how crucial was your following?
That was devastating, personally, very devastating. I definitely operated that from a place of authenticity and, you know, my personal account, I use my birth date to open it, you know, all my friends and family that followed me, the human being, and having to hand over something like that felt like a violation of my privacy. And it was terrifying for a while. But I'm also grateful because the relationships had staying power. And so many of those people that realized what had happened, they were very quick to move over to wherever I had gone. And that is something that has kept me moving, you know, with a lot of optimism. And I think social media is something you have to be close to the fire in, you know, especially when it comes to sharing your life. And if you are putting yourself out there and you are sharing your craft, you obviously have a responsibility in it, but those relationships are real. They're real in a lot of ways. We're all human. And I'm just looking forward to rebuilding, but also carrying with me a sense of self that I think has stayed authentic.
Yeah. And when you talk about those relationships, I mean, they were so instrumental to one, you finding that resilience and that strength. But where did you find the inspiration and creativity to completely recreate your business?
It's always come from her. And that's kind of why she is. Cheval was the phrase we went with as a brand, because that inspiration is, it's evergreen, it's everlasting. It always comes from that interaction and that bit of chemistry, that storyline, that personality, that bit of joy expressed. And when you do look at it from that perspective, it's endless and it feels like the limit does not exist and you can run against the wind and move forward. But I think that's one of the best parts about branding is that it is about human relationships. And while there can be sparkly, gorgeous products, it's the connection that where the magic happens.
How do you describe the designs in Chia Cheval? Who is the customer that you envision?
offbeat for sure. I was not afraid to be really emotional with my design approach and creative approach. Coming from an industry that is, you know, built on love and this really big special moment, that's always been within me. And so I didn't shy away from any of that. It's a very special brand. It's specialty footwear. But we're really just getting our feeding, you know, and learning this industry and learning what she wants from us. And so we're very much approaching this from a listening factor of we're going to do our best. We know we're going to make mistakes in some areas, but we want to see where this goes. And I was very eclectic with the assortment. So there is a lot of sneakers and flats, but then we've also got some fabulous sky-high heels, even some slippers. And yeah, I think down the road, there could be more opportunity for other categories and accessory lines, so long as they're non-competitive with my former employer. So that leaves a pretty big landscape for me, which is exciting.
Yeah, something for everyone and just the beginning for you. I want to get into your nonprofit that you launched, A Girl You Might Know. Where did the name come from?
A Girl You Might Know is just a phrase that I had been going by publicly during the period where I was still within the contract period. My contract period actually didn't end until August of 2022. So there was this period.
Not that long ago.
Yeah, it's not that long ago. And that was actually when I was hoping to be able to go back into my trade set, which ended up not being the case. But it's definitely presented an interesting landscape just because shoes are a whole new realm, but to have a mission behind it in all that I've been through, A Girl You Might Know was really this identity in a way. And it's a reminder of that storyline. And so I loved it as the name of the foundation. Because it could be any girl you might know that goes through something like this, or any person. And really, it's just about safeguarding and providing some type of resource. I think there's also a lot of youth out there that's starting their careers that don't have access to attorneys, either financially, or they just don't know what's involved in the complexity of a contract process or negotiating. And so we really wanted to put it all out there and start that conversation. And I think it's even more important to start thinking about thoughtful legislation for social media presence, because this is such a new territory and there is very little case law. We have to be so mindful of that in protecting people's identities, but also, you know, doing the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, and what I love about it is you talk about having attorneys, you know, for young artists and entrepreneurs. But the fact that there's a lot of like attorneys that are showing up that are willing to be part of your nonprofit, it shows that there's actually a need for this.
It's outstanding to see how many people have come forward and say, I want to support this. I want to contribute hours. I want to be a guide for them. I feel this shift from like influencers to leaders. And I think that it gives me the chills. It's such an exciting thing because people that do want to stand up and be a real guiding light, stand on my shoulders, I will help you get there. It is just such a good vibe. So we're gonna harness that as much as we can.
And there's a grant application too, correct?
Yes. So the grant application is financial based, and we will award one young creator or entrepreneur even that's looking to start a small business. There's a whole application process involved. There's a review period. We've got some great people on our advisory board from all walks of life, a lot of really strong, powerful women. And yeah, we just want to provide those financial resources and stability to get someone started out on that right foot.
Given that, I mean, you really have just defied the odds that were laid in front of you, but is this time also a little bittersweet?
Yes, it is. I do still feel very vulnerable at times. I think that just happens when you're in a massive lawsuit. And I tried really hard to compartmentalize parts of my life so that I am still showing up the way that I feel good about myself and that I have a good impact on people. I think it's all about being human in a lot of ways, and knowing that there is going to be some major valleys, but climbing the mountains and getting over to the other side is just part of the journey, you know? So keep trucking.
Keep trucking. Cheval, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Vicky.
Yeah, you can write a book on career pivots, that's for sure.
Oh, I'd love to. That's a great idea.
Cheval is a shoe designer who also calls herself a chief inspiration officer, using her life-changing story as an entrepreneur to help other young business owners. Cheval is also the founder of the nonprofit A Girl You Might Know to support young females and creatives, which includes guidance on their legal rights so they avoid being subjected to unfair terms. We have more information on our Insight page. Still ahead, we'll meet a volunteer group called Petal Connection, and they are behind life-changing floral arrangements. They deliver bouquets to hospice patients and seniors across the Sacramento region. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. Excuse me, I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. I need more coffee. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Seemingly small acts of kindness can be quite powerful. And a volunteer-led nonprofit knows a thoughtful gift to strangers can bring some joy during some of the most difficult moments in life. The Petal Connection delivers fresh floral bouquets from donated flowers to local hospice patients and seniors. And over the years, they've learned that these arrangements can be life-changing. Jennifer Airy is the founder of the Petal Connection and joins us now. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
This is such a wonderful concept. How did it begin?
You know, it really began 11 years ago when my grandmother was in hospice. And if you've ever had someone in hospice, and many of us have, you realize there's not a lot to talk about. You're kind of stuck inside. It's a little bit quiet, a little bit dreary. And we just started bringing in my grandmother's flowers from her yard. We're literally bringing the outside in. And just seeing how it can make a difference, bringing in the beauty, really kind of started the whole movement here in our community. And a friend told me about a similar mission that was going on in Oregon. And we said, a year later, I thought, you know what, this is something we can do, something we can pull off in this community. So we started in my garage, getting donated flowers from local grocers and local events, and just friends, and started pulling together flowers just to spread joy, just so they could make a difference in someone's life.
I think the fact that this began over a decade ago and it's still going strong and this is a volunteer-run organization shows that, you know, you're not the only one that has this personal connection to what it is to care for someone in hospice or care for someone in the later stages of their life.
Right. I mean, no one is more overwhelmed than me. You know, it started out as such a small act and it's really just turned into something, like you said, I didn't understand so much of this community needed. So many of our elderly are living longer or in living facilities. And as we all know, through these past couple of years, how isolation affects you, you know, or being thought that everyone forgot you or you're trapped inside. Seniors and facilities and on hospice are very, very lonely. And getting that flower arrangement that comes in and just says, you matter in this world. and just seeing the beauty that is out there that can be shared with others. And I found through, yeah, like you said, we're starting our 10th year, which is just fantastic. Just the ripple effect of, like, the nurses tell me, you know, you make our job easier. No one wants to be on hospice. And I remember that with my grandmother. She was not happy, right? And she's like, you gave me that gift that I could bring in and really make a connection. They connect with their patients. You know, they found out they're gardeners, or we have a lot of wives. And my husband used to always bring me flowers. We just got a letter the other day, said he was that kind of man. He brought her flowers all the time. And right now he's, you know, on hospice. And she goes, and these flowers start coming in. It's like, he's still bringing me flowers. We're both enjoying them. It was part of our life. And just the difference they make was more than I could even fathom. I guess that's the exciting part of it for us, being that we are about to turn 10 years old, is that the need is great. You know, everyone wants joy. Everyone wants, and especially seniors, they want to know, yeah, I'm not forgotten. And someone remembered me. And in an incredibly beautiful, awesome way. I mean, what we do, I'm super proud of. A lot of people have said, oh, you give, you know, dying flowers to dying people. I'm like, oh, no, no, no. I mean, the flowers we get are simply incredible. You know, we love when we get them after like a wedding or an event, which are back, thank goodness. That was kind of a low part when the weddings were canceled. But I mean, they've only been used for a few hours and they're spectacular. And we take them apart and figure out what's good and make these smaller bedside bouquets that the nurses can deliver to their patients, to their families. And it just, like I said, the ripple effect, it touches so many. Our volunteers are just, if you would come into our shop right now, I guarantee you there's music playing and they're on a high with just all of the fun that they have together, knowing that they can do something awesome for someone else.
Yeah. I mean, on the surface, we may be talking about floral arrangements, but obviously it is so much more for those receiving it. And as you just said, the volunteers as well, it shapes their own lives. I was reading some of the testimonials. You posted one on Instagram from the Petal Connections Instagram account saying that they're life-changing arrangements because flowers have a way that speak to those who listen. And I love that. Did you always know that flowers in this way could make someone's day and remind them of the joy that can exist during really difficult times?
Yeah. You know, I had no idea, really. My mom was always a florist, so it wasn't, I was familiar with flowers. But this journey that we've been on these 10 years has really been impactful for my life and for everyone. I just had no idea in that how it could change someone's life in such a simple manner. We all tried to do these big, grandiose things. And really, it gets down to the little powerful things that really do make a difference, and color. And like I said, beauty of the outside coming in. And really, the journey that we've been on has been unexpected and overwhelmingly amazing. And I think it does happen in a community like ours, you know. Some people are like, oh, do you want to open one up somewhere else? And I think it really works in our community because of the way the community supports each other. I talk about weddings, but I would say our biggest floral donors are Raley's, Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, Nugget Markets. So instead of them throwing their flowers into the trash, they donate them to us. And like I said, we're not giving out dying flowers. They're spectacular flowers we receive, but we really do sort through and make sure they're really, really going to last because we want that beauty to touch them days upon days. But like I said, it's in a community like this what has really embraced our mission of spreading joy that I feel like we've had the success. And I feel like we can just keep growing. You know, there's really no stopping us because it's never ending. It's, you know, it's always, someone is always in need of some joy. Yeah. And Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, there's always someone that would like some warmth during trying moments, from loneliness to caretaking to living through a front row seat of a really profound loss. So how does it work? Can you walk us through the steps from when you receive? Sure. We know that the flowers are donated, but how do you select the recipients?
Yeah, the recipients. Well, we started with the one hospice that took care of my grandmother. So we started there originally, and then we started getting more flowers. Got a couple other hospices, and right now we give to 15 different hospice agencies. And because of HEPA, we don't get to deliver them, right? It is that privacy thing. So really, they are the angels that come into our shop. We work Monday through Wednesday, making sure that we, you know, they tell us about how many people they need, and we donate to them, and they take them to their patients. Like I said, so the nurses, they get to select, and they know, like they say, I know that she's told me her favorite color is purple. And, you know, a nurse has stopped me once in the parking lot, you know, she needs hydrangeas, you know. And then on the other hand, the recipients will call us and say, you know, how did you know? How did you know my grandmother loved hydrangeas? And I'm like, we didn't, you know, they just found, there's so many ways that the flowers are finding the correct people. It's just amazing. And I've just really, we've all just let it flow. The stories are never ending, truly, because there's always some unique way of how they're getting used and how someone is being touched by them. You know, people say, I've had a horrible, horrible day. I don't know, is today the day my person or my loved one is going to pass? And you change that horrible day. And I mean, it's just overwhelming, and it's a reason for us not to stop. But like I said, I think the hardest thing for us to get, which is crazy, is the flowers. We have the volunteer manpower. We have a wait list, which is fantastic and overwhelming. Our volunteers are so enthusiastic, though. We send out jobs to be doing on Fridays, and boom, they fill up because these people want in there, and we can't fit any more new volunteers because we have such a thriving group. And we have more hospice providers that would like more bouquets. There's more love to spread. And really, we get stopped at the flowers. We love it. Like after Valentine's Day, we always said that's our Super Bowl, everything that doesn't sell. We anticipate after Easter being beautiful. We love like wedding season, but to the point where we even started growing our own flowers during COVID, when things were, we knew we didn't want to slow down at all times, especially right then. But we had someone reach out to us and said, what if I start growing new flowers in honor of my mom? I'll never forget that. That's wonderful. I thought, my gosh, it was crazy. So we grow our own flowers in the summer. Really, it sky's the limit. So yeah, it's exciting.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Airy is the founder of the Petal Connection. It is a nonprofit volunteer organization who designs fresh floral bouquets from donated flowers to give to local hospice patients as well as seniors. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Tuesday. We will catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.